Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and call the Judiciary Committee to order. And at this time, I'll open the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary.
Open the House Judiciary Committee as well.
So thank you all very much for being here on a beautiful afternoon. We are going to try to work through our material as quick as we can. I know that we have members who have other obligations that are going to start needing to leave, I believe, around 3:30. So that's our goal, to try to get out shortly there, before or thereafter. So with that, we are going to have two informational hearings. The first one is reducing recidivism rates for driving under the influence of offenses. We have three panels that are going to be presenting this afternoon, and the first panel is going to be Michael Schmidt and Kelly Officer. Why don't y'all please come forward. And our next panel, just for those who are wanting to know how we're going to proceed, Dr. John Fitzgerald and Heidi Brockman Estrue will be our second panel, and then the third panel will be Judge Edward Jones. So Mike, if you and Kelly could get us teed off, that'd be great.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, House and Senate Judiciary Committees. Yes. My name is Mike Schmidt. I work for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission.
And I'm Kelly Officer, a research analyst with the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission.
So it's an honor and a privilege to be here on this side of the table in front of the Judiciary Committees today instead of sitting up there with you all. So this is a welcome change.
We'll see about that.
Yeah, we'll see. We're all teeing you up.
That's right. Now we're ready.
That was a bad starter.
Yeah. I should have learned.
Okay, so we may be here till 4 o'clock.
In front of you, hopefully you have the Oregon, a worksheet entitled Oregon DUII Data.
Nope,
we do not.
That's a big help.
Okay. So we'll have copies, but once you kind of just realize that we may not have it right this moment, and you kind of give us the picture, and then we'll be able to catch up with you.
Great.
All of it?
So, members of both committees, this data is actually data that the CJC compiled back in 2011, I believe, surrounding the Measure 73 conversation that was happening in DUII. So the data is a little bit old, but we suspect that not much has changed in this area. But we certainly could look further into that. This is data that we received from Oregon DMV and put into these charts because at the time there was a lot of conversation about fatalities, dealing with DUIs. And so what you'll see on this data is that the number of, it breaks out the percentages of all DUI arrests, how many had zero priors, one prior, two priors, three priors. And so you can see exactly what that makeup looks like. And it was a little surprising to me to look at this, but maybe not to all of you who are familiar with that Measure 73 conversation, that 97% of DUIs between 2007 and 2009, 97% of all of those were first-time DUI.
And that's, just for clarification, talking about with a fatality.
That is with a fatality. That's correct. And when you total look at the total number without either an assault or a manslaughter, so no assault or death, it's 94%. So of all of the DUI arrests and convictions, 94% had zero priors, like convictions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have this in front of you, you can see of those who had zero priors, how many were involved in assaults, which was 5.5%, and how many were associated with a manslaughter, 4%, or 53 cases. If you go down that chart and look at the people with one prior, two priors, three priors, four priors, and all, you can see that the vast majority of DUIs that involved an assault or a manslaughter was first-time offenders. So that's what the data that we presented in 2011 on Measure 73 shows. And on the back of that handout that we provided the committee, we also look at the arrest and charge rates of DUIs from 2000 to 2008. And over that time period, there was a decrease of 26%. So steadily, it's been going down.
So, Mike, just for clarification, since our copy is not colored, looking at that graph, is it fair to assume that the first top line is for arrests, the second is charges, and the third, the one, the lower part, is convictions?
That's correct. So I'll note in all of this data, and I guess the one big takeaway that I want to leave this committee with before I turn it over to my co-presenter to talk about what studies have been done concerning IID specifically, is DUII data is very difficult to really get at. And so you'll notice at the bottom of this picture, we put a little asterisk that say we have to deal with municipal court convictions and out-of-state convictions, and when dealing with misdemeanors, it's very hard for us to track this data. So if I can leave this committee with one takeaway, tracking of this kind of information could be done better in Oregon, and that would be a useful thing for us going forward. But with that, my co-presenter, Kelly Officer, who does most of our data things at the CJC, has looked at a study recently put out by WSIP. It's a meta-analysis, and she's here to talk about that and how it relates to IIDs.
Thank you. So I am a research analyst at the Criminal Justice Commission.
Kelly, I need you to put your name on the record, please.
Oh, Kelly Officer, okay. With the Criminal Justice Commission. Thank you. So at the Criminal Justice Commission, I do a lot of work on program evaluations, mostly dealing with intervention programs for those involved in the criminal justice system. I've done a little bit of work with DUI offenders, not a whole lot. So when we had this request today to come present to you, the first thing we did was try to look at the research that has been done on the effectiveness of IIDs. So we were not able to find a study that shows the effectiveness of IIDs for first-time offenders. So I am not aware of a study that's been done on that, and others, it sounds like, are also not aware of that study. I'm also not aware of any studies that have been done specifically in Oregon on IID effectiveness. So as far as we're aware, that research has not been done yet. I will say that it sounds like there would be a pretty good opportunity to do some research around that. So to do research on the effectiveness of IIDs in Oregon, specifically for Oregon offenders, for either first-time or repeat DUI offenders, sounds like a very good opportunity of research that could be pursued. So since we don't have any Oregon-specific data, we looked at the Washington State Institute of Public Policy. They're a research agency in Washington. They have a very long history of doing both cost-benefit analysis and meta-analysis work. So a meta-analysis is like a study of studies. So you do a big literature review, come up with all the studies, and then combine those results. So they have done this in several different areas. So and if you look in criminal justice, you'll find drug courts that have done a meta-analysis with 60-plus studies. In other areas, they'll have a meta-analysis with 40 studies. For this particular meta-analysis, there are only 4 studies that they found to include in this. So while it is a meta-analysis and it is combining results from multiple areas, it's only 4 studies. So, you know, your degree of confidence in that will be swayed by the fact that there's only the 4 of those. So I think you have the handout to show the WSIP results. Looks like this. Yeah, very good. Okay. So WSIP has those 4 studies, and so when they do a meta-analysis, they have a statistical model to take the result of those 4 studies and combine them all. So let's say we have this study with a sample size of 100, had a 10% effect size. This study with a sample size of 300 had a 15% effect size, and they have a way that they combine all of those into a single result for those studies. So that's what WSIP has done here. The important thing about this work of WSIP, it's only for repeat DUII offenders. So these 4 studies were on repeat DUII offenders that were looking at the effectiveness of being required to have the IID or not, and comparing the subsequent DUI arrests of those 2 groups. The IID is required to be on for 12 to 24 months, and it's also, for all of these studies, the compliance was done by a state agency like the DMV, not by the courts. So that's the type of programs that these 4 studies looked at. So WSIP combined the results of these, and so they looked at the effectiveness of having the IID required either on the person's vehicle or the person being required to drive a vehicle with an IID device, and then looked at subsequent DUI arrest rates. So for those that were required to have the IID compared to those that were not, there was an effect size, and it was 64%, which was statistically significant. That's a pretty large effect size. So there were 64% fewer subsequent DUI arrests for those required to have the IID devices. They also looked at the rearrest rates after the IID device was removed, either at the 12 or 24-month mark. So then they followed subsequently past that to see if they continued to see effect size after the IID was removed from the vehicle, and they no longer had that requirement. So there was still an effect size of 39.8%, which is statistically significantly higher than zero. So they were still seeing an effect after the device was removed, but it dropped quite a bit, right? It went from 64% down to 39.8%. So after the device was removed, we do see that drop in the effectiveness, but it is still much higher than it was without ever having that requirement in the first place. I did say that this was based only on those four studies, but one of those studies is a randomized controlled trial, which is what we call the gold standard in program evaluation. And so since one of those studies was a randomized controlled trial, that would give us more merit looking at that as evaluators. So this was a study done in Maryland on repeat DUI offenders, and they randomly assigned which offenders would be required to have the IID and which would not. And so by designing the study that way, it's the most rigorous program evaluation, and it reduces a lot of the selection bias. The other studies would have had to find those offenders that had the IID and try to find the best comparison that they could, either in a subsequent county or the year prior to a law being changed or something like that. So when you're doing that, it introduces more selection bias into the study. So since one of those studies is that randomized controlled trial design, we would put a lot more merit into that, and we did provide you a copy of that study as well. Looks like this. So it's a randomized controlled trial done in Maryland on IIDs for repeat DUII offenders. So in that specific RCT in Maryland on repeat DUII offenders, in the first year, when they were required to have the IID device, the effect size was 36%, and that was statistically significant. In the second year, they were no longer required to have that IID device, and that effect size did drop by quite a bit, and it was no longer significant in the second year. So for that second year, where'd it go? It dropped quite a bit. Right there? Oh, yes. Right. So it dropped to 3.5%, which was not significantly different from zero in that second year. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Anything else? Move on to the presentation. Questions? Senator Roebling.
Yeah, and my concern is when I look at your first data, it shows how few people are multiple offenders. And therefore, I get concerned when we use percentages because the N size is so small. So what would, do we know the N size in the study in Maryland?
Yes, let's find that really fast. So, you know, the dynamics in Maryland are much different than the dynamics in Oregon. I think to qualify for this program in Maryland, they had to be three-time repeat DUII offenders. And, of course, they do that over time to get enough of a sample size into the study. So it looks like there were 158 in the treatment group. Right. So I'm assuming there was a similar sample size in the control group.
Follow up?
Yes. So I get concerned when we use that kind of data in these informational deals because the sample sizes are so small to make projections over the whole issue. And clearly from the first data that we have about total numbers, if we really wanted to be effective, we'd put IEDs on all cars before anybody got a drunk driving ticket. So if you're going to start your car, you're blowing the deal. I mean, because the people who are causing the deaths are the people who have never gotten caught before. So, I mean, if you really want to have some kind of effect with them. Now, it's clear that there is an effect if you have them, and it works with people who have been multiply offended or not. But if you're really going to try to cut down on deaths, anyway, it's interesting to me to look at the numbers. Mm-hmm.
So. Other questions for this panel?
Yeah.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Chair. So on Michael, on the arrest chart you had, so there's a significant drop between arrests and convictions, and is that because of diversion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that's what we believe.
Okay, and then my second question, the arrests are going down, and I'm reading in the Oregonian about the lack of law enforcement throughout the state. We think we're having less drunk drivers, or are we just lacking the enforcement? I mean, or some combination of the two, maybe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I believe there probably is some combination of the two. As what I do for the CJC, generally with the 3194 data and looking at arrests and prison usage, we see a lot of that, especially in certain counties. And so if you were to pull this data out county by county, I think it would really show maybe a different picture depending on where you're looking.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions or comments? Thank you very much. I believe our next panel is going to be Dr. John Fitzgerald and Heidi Brockman Struve.
So do I need to speak into the mic, or can I stand?
If you bring the mic over.
Yeah, bring the mic over. It's very sensitive, so you don't need to be on top of it.
This will work fine.
Yeah, I think you should be. We'll find out. Mike will be able to tell us if he's picking you up or not.
Okay, good. John Fitzgerald. I am adjunct faculty in the Department of Psychiatry at OHSU. I've taught the graduate treatment courses at Lewis and Clark and Portland State. I've had a private practice where I've treated addiction. I've also, at OHSU, treated people who have DUIs. Presently, I work for a pharmaceutical company that makes pain medicines, and I'm very involved in issues related to the FDA on overdose death. But today, I've been asked to speak more specifically about treatment and what we know about treatment and effectiveness, and so that's what I'm going to stick to. And what I really want to do is focus on two things. I want to provide a little bit of information around what do we really know about the nature of this problem, and then given that, what really are the recommendations that follow? If you listen to nothing else, I'll give you my top line, and that is we need to extend treatment. We need to extend treatment. And people need to be in treatment longer than 3 or 4 months. Now I'll give you the presentation, and you can see the data, and you guys can make up kind of your decisions. But let's see here. Hopes if I turn this on. And I'm going to hit my timer so I don't go over here. Okay. So one of the things that we know is that for people who struggle with addiction and a variety of challenging problems, for 90% of people, it begins prior to the age of 20. And truthfully, it's really 80% prior to the age of 15. So when we look at who is it that really struggles in terms of addiction, substance abuse problems, we're really talking about a problem that begins in adolescence, early life. And the question is, what happens in these early years that take a group of people and go down the path of addiction, substance abuse, lots of different kinds of co-occurring problems, and other people seem to avoid that? So one of the things I want to show you just briefly here is you can see in these slides, here's the onset, 12 to 13-year-olds, 14, 15. You can see this incredible onset early on. Here's another slide that shows percentage of males having 4 or more drinks on any single day in the last 30 days. Again, what I want to show you is it's these early years where we see the incline of people going down the path to starting to have problems. So what's that about? Well, one of the things that we know is that there is a collection of risk factors and protective factors that help us to understand in a broad way who goes down these different paths. And what we've done through research is we have a variety of different domains. We have individual that are nested in families and peer groups, schools, communities. In each of these different domains, we've identified a variety of risk factors. The ones that are up here tend to be the really important risk factors. So if you want to understand the trajectory of somebody that ultimately ends up in the system, getting a DUI, multiple DUIs, if they have early aggressive behavior, kind of connected up with parents who don't have good supervision and boundaries, they start early on experimenting with smoking marijuana, pills, alcohol at a young age. The best predictor of future substance abuse is past substance abuse. So we start seeing people going down the path. I've done a tremendous amount of research in communities all over the United States where we know that poverty, when people lose their jobs, these communities are decimated, and poverty is a huge predictor of substance abuse. We also know that there's a variety of protective factors, that when kids early on have impulse control, when parents know who their friends are, when they stay on top of schoolwork, academic competence, anti-drug use policies, these are basically your framework for prevention right here. Now, what I want to do to help you understand a bit more about the challenges that we face from a treatment standpoint with the people that come into the system is to go a little bit deeper. Have any of you guys heard of the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, the ACE study? A couple of you. Good. A few of you have. All right. So I'm going to talk very briefly about it. This occurred back in the 80s. It was down in Kaiser in San Diego. It was a weight loss program for women. The women that were dropping the most weight dropped out of the program. So the Kaiser folks wondered, what's going on here? Have we stumbled upon a great formula for weight loss? Researchers came in and discovered that, no, in fact, the women that dropped out regained the weight. And part of what had happened was that they had early experiences and they had learned to use food as a way of managing their emotional world around these early adverse experiences. Researchers wondered, is it just women? Is it just food? So they developed a very big study with the Center for Disease Control, CDC, and they ran about 20,000 people through the Kaiser system, all ages, men, women. And what they did was they asked them about these factors right here. They said, at any time in your life, have you ever experienced any of these issues? And what they found, and they did this as part of their routine care, so that they got a very nice sample. And what they found was that 12.5% of the total had four or more adverse childhood experiences. About a little over a third of them said, no, haven't had any of those. We believe that this data and these outcomes actually are a bit conservative. But you can go to the CDC website on adverse childhood experiences, and there's lots of publications on this. What we also found is that there's a strong graded relationship between number of adverse childhood experiences and all of these things, including alcohol. In other words, the more adverse childhood experiences, the more of all of this we see. So if we go a little bit more specific, we can see here's smoking. Percentage of people smoking, percentage of alcoholics, and you can see the graded relationship. The more adverse childhood experiences, the more of people drinking, smoking. So the lead person of this study said addiction is not a brain disease, nor is it caused by chemical imbalances or genetics. Addiction is best viewed as an understandable, unconscious, compulsive use of psychoactive materials in response to abnormal prior life experiences, most of which are concealed by shame, secrecy, social taboo. So I have two stories. This is one of them that I want to tell you. And this is about a DUI client that came in to see me at OHSU. And he was wearing a suit, came in, we sat down. He was from a South American country. And normally when we do DUI work, we get right to it. Got our clipboard, we got our evaluation, we jump in. In this case, I set it aside, and I knew I needed to talk to him. Because one of the things we know about doing good clinical work is if you don't have a relationship with the person that you're treating, you tend not to get very good outcomes. You can imagine that people can be fairly defensive. So I probably spent 45 minutes talking nothing about DUI or alcohol with this client until I felt that we had a connection. I said, we got to get to your DUI. Tell me what happened the night you got your DUI. He said it was a Friday night. I was out on my own. I went to a bar. So I'm thinking, this is a good-looking guy. He's dressed in a suit. He's out Friday night by himself at a bar. He says, I want to get lucky. I know what that means. I said, what happened? He says, I go to a bar. I buy this gal a drink. Her boyfriend shows up. So I'm really embarrassed. So I leave. What happens next? I go to another bar. I kind of try something similar. I get embarrassed. It doesn't work out. So as an evaluator, I might say, and then you left and you got your DUI. But I really went much slower than I'm going with you. And he finally said, you know, I just drove around. And I said, drove around like cruising? Cruising for prostitutes? No, nothing like that. But I opened the door and he said, you know, I went to an adult bookstore. I said, okay, what happened? And, you know, I just went in and walked around. Fair enough. Was it one of the ones where you can go in the back and masturbate? He looks down. I can tell. This is not getting comfortable for him. And he has to make decisions. Is he going to tell me the truth, or is he just going to say, no, and we're going to move on with the DUI? He says, yeah. Did you go back there? I did. I said, I know. I can tell this is challenging for you. Tell me what you masturbated to. Oh, you can tell. You can just see the shame in his face. He says, I've never told anybody this. He says, I was masturbating to muscular women, and I don't know why. I've been doing it my whole life. I said, okay, tell me about the first time you had sex. And in therapy, we have these moments called aha moments where you know, you can just look in your client, and you're like, and he looks at me and he says, I was 12 years old. I was upstairs. I heard my dad come up the stairs. He came in. He said, it's time. I didn't know what he meant. We went downstairs, got in the car. We drove for a while. It was nighttime. We got to a house. We walked in the house, and there were these women against a wall. And my dad says, pick one. And he said, it's time for you to become a man. So in our country, what do we call a 12-year-old boy having sex with an adult woman? Does it have anything to do with becoming a man? It was a trauma. And so you can start seeing how this guy's history starts unfolding and how an early trauma that creates a tremendous amount of shame develops, and he continues to start seeking out a variety of pornography that links with his early trauma. If this guy got typical DUI treatment and it was all about alcohol, he would continue to drink and continue to struggle. What he needed was something very, very different than just psychoeducation and alcohol treatment. And it goes back to this issue of shame, secrecy, and social taboo. What did he want? He wanted a relationship. He wanted to get married. He wanted to have kids. He didn't know how to do that. Now, at the same time that we have this study, we have Nora Volkow, director of NIDA, who said many times, drug addiction is a brain disease. So who's right? Is it about underlying events or is it about a brain disease? Well, it's both, right? I mean, addiction's a complex problem. It's both. So I apologize. I was hoping to bring one of my slides on alcohol, but this is cocaine. And I just want to make a clear point. This is brain glucose metabolism of a normal subject. And basically, the way to read this is it's just brain activity and how well the brain's functioning. And here's a cocaine abuser. 10 days after use, you can see there's a big difference after this guy stopped after 10 days. Here's 100 days after he stopped cocaine, and you can see a huge difference. We don't show people anymore the broken egg on the firing pan. We show people real brain images. Average treatment for DUIs is 3 to 4 months. This guy, look at 100 days and he's getting out. Is it any surprise that we see recidivism and relapse? All right, so what we've done from neuroimaging is we've taken that and we've looked at how does addiction compare to other chronic illnesses like diabetes, hypertension, and asthma. And if you look at relapse rates, they line up. The difference is that when we treat chronic medical conditions, we treat them with a continuance of care model. It's malpractice if a doctor would say, you've done such a great job managing your diabetes, I don't need to see you. Come back if you have a problem. We don't do that. It's what we do in addiction treatment. Addiction treatment works while people are in treatment. When they get out, most cases, it's aftercare. And most aftercare tends to be self-help, and most people don't stick with self-help. So they relapse. So part of what I'm trying to make a case for is that we need to move from an acute care model to a chronic care model for people who have addictions, other co-occurring disorders. I want to make one final point before I talk about my recommendations, and I want to check my time. Okay, all right. So when people come into the program, we put a tremendous amount, program meaning they get a DUI, there's often an incredible focus on alcohol. But in my experience as a clinician, and Heidi's going to speak to this as well, what we see when we do a thorough evaluation is there's a whole lot of stuff going on. It's not just alcohol. So to a large extent, in order for treatment to be effective, we have to treat the whole package of behavior. When I started off as a clinician, I went and visited all the residential programs in Portland, and I would look at their list of what the day looked like, and they had more smoke breaks built into their day than they had treatment groups. And I said to the director, I said, you don't think smoking is an addiction? Smoking and alcohol hit the same receptors in the brain. Smoking is an addiction. It's a dangerous addiction. We have to treat the whole package. And we don't do that right now. All right, so what do we do? So here's my 4 recommendations to you. This first one, I've already said, we need to extend the length of time in treatment. So if you get a first-time DUI, 6 months minimum seems to make a lot of sense. I've talked to a variety of my colleagues in the research and clinical world. 2 years, 2 DUIs or more, 1 year minimum. These are minimums. So if I'm an evaluator and somebody comes in with their first DUI and I'm doing my evaluation and I find that they've been drinking for 30 years, they have underlying trauma, they have a whole lot of issues, they're going to need a lot more than 6 months. You saw my brain imaging, and we have a whole lot of research and data to show that people need a lot more than 3 or 4 months. So we need to extend the length of treatment. The second is that in order for us to do better at treatment, we have to get better at evaluation. I think Heidi's going to talk a little bit about this. I know that we have sort of a middleman where people get a DUI, they get evaluated by the county, they get sent to a treatment provider. I know a lot of times people get multiple evaluations. They often have social services. So I've had clients where in the first month of me seeing them, they've been evaluated four times. And it gets pretty old answering the same questions four different times. It's very inefficient. But to a large extent, what we have to do is get more effective at how we evaluate. So here's a client. This is not totally uncommon for a client that has a lot going on. And one of the issues that I want to make, and my point to you, is that in our system, we have limited time and limited resources. So we have to get good at figuring out where's the leverage point. If we're going to do something, where's the leverage point? So one of the first things is that even though we identify lots of issues with clients, they're related. They're a system. And so if we intervene on one of these issues, we end up by intervening on the system. So in this particular client, for those of you who are seeing this slide, if you were to pick one issue up here that was the leverage point for making a difference in treatment, what would you say? What would you pick? Just say it out loud. What's the issue up here that made the biggest difference for treatment? Yes.
I would have said depression.
Depression. No. Somebody else.
Somebody else. They're not
going to
say
that. Yes. How is it?
Sorry?
Housing.
No.
Why don't you tell us?
I have a point to make. So just tell me what you think. It's a very important point, and you're helping me make it. What else? What is it? Can you identify what would be the leverage point that made a difference in treatment?
Friends.
No.
That you're doing the whole thing.
I'll cut to the chase because I know we have a limited time. What made a difference is sleep apnea. And you know what? I've done this presentation to graduate students, to professionals, and they do what you do. They say everything else up there except sleep apnea. What we know from the field of system science is that leverage points, powerful leverage points for change, are not obvious. They're not obvious. What we do is we go for the obvious. And it turns out that for this client, this person didn't get any sleep. They would come in, they were so tired. No wonder we couldn't make any progress in treatment. As soon as this person got Provigil, got CPAP machine, had a sleep disorders evaluation, all of these other things started working and we were able to make progress in treatment. But the point is, if we can't identify these leverage points and go after them, our treatments aren't very effective. And given that we have limited time and resources, we really need to go after this stuff. I've given a handout to you, so I won't talk much about this, but we have a whole variety of evidence-based practices that we need to be using. The one that I want you to give some thought to is addiction medications, because they're underutilized. We now have extended-release naltrexone. We have a depot drug, goes in 30 days, lots of evidence that it cuts down craving, and when combined with treatment, can make a big difference. Yes, it costs $500 to $1,000 per month, but when you look at the cost of jail and other interventions, it's pretty cost-effective, and there's a bunch of new papers coming out that are showing that not only does it work for alcohol, we've got just as much efficacy that it works for opioids. And a lot of people now are getting DUIs specific to opioids, not alcohol. So I would encourage you to think about the use of medications. My last one is just what I'll end on, and that is that we operate so much in a field of pathology where we see these people that come in as problems, and we diagnose, and we label. And in fact, for the majority of my clinical career, we used the DSM-IV, which had substance abuse and substance dependence. Most of you maybe know by now that criteria made no sense. We've gotten rid of substance abuse. We now have alcohol use disorders. For 15 years, the researchers thought they had it right, and they didn't. We reanalyzed all the data, and we completely rewrote the book on how we diagnose. But for all that time that I diagnosed people as abuse or dependence, they got a label. And labels stick with people. And so in some ways, we need to not only see our patients as problems, but we need to look at the other side of the equation. So the little girl's in the back of the room, she's drawing, the teacher says, what are you drawing? You might have heard this on a TED Talk, and she says, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher says, no one knows what God looks like, and she says, they will in a minute. And Picasso says, all children are artists. The problem is how to remain an artist once he grows up. We excel at making a living. We fail at making a life. We celebrate our prosperity. We yearn for purpose. We cherish our freedoms, but long for connection. In an age of plenty, we feel spiritual hunger. So my last point to you is we need to incorporate positive psychology. We need to assess people when they come in for their natural talents and their gifts. And we need to figure out, if you're not drinking and using and depressed and doing all this stuff, what should you be doing in your life? And how can we get you to do that? Because that's our best relapse prevention right there. Get people to figure out what they're good at, what they should be doing in life, and we're going to solve most of this problem. But I guarantee you, you go out and you go and sit in treatment programs and sit in groups and see how much you hear about us assessing natural talents and skills and how to help people optimize their life. We see people as problems, and then they continue to see themselves as problems, and it goes back to the whole shame issue, and we wonder why we don't get very far. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to go ahead and go with the other presenter, and then we'll come back for questions.
Yes.
Excellent. My name is Heidi Brockman-Astrid, and I run a treatment facility up in Multnomah County. And my part of this presentation is really about taking some of the things that John talked about and applying it and thinking about it in terms of how we here in Oregon handle DUI and DUI treatment. And so a couple of things, as I was preparing and choosing what I could possibly speak to you about, one of the things that I had my staff do was take a look at who was in our program this year, in 2014, who presented themselves. And what we found was pretty interesting, actually. What we discovered was, of the folks presenting in our program, about 25% of them identified as having a drug of choice, their primary drug of choice, other than alcohol. So marijuana, cocaine, benzodiazepines, it was any number of things, but not necessarily alcohol. And so what I would humbly wish for in this process is that we define and think about DUI in terms of impaired driving. Driving, which is a concern for all of us, but really thinking about it in terms of not just alcohol, but all of the ways that we are compromised when we're operating a motor vehicle. And it's very important that we make sure that some of us call them sanctions that we put in place for individuals receiving a DUI. I like to think of it as interventions. We need to make sure that these hit the majority of the population, or the biggest percent of the population that is possible. So that being said, I know we had an earlier conversation about interlock devices, and I certainly think that there are absolutely good applications for interlock devices. But I just want to share with you the story of a client that I had earlier this year, and he was on his bicycle, and he was hit by a motorist and taken to the hospital for emergency medical services, where he received a blood test. In that blood test, there was THC present in his system, likely in impairing quantities, but he was charged with a DUI as a result of that incident. The way that the current interlock rules are in terms of diversion, this gentleman was required to have an interlock machine, which only tests for alcohol, put on his car. So not an effective intervention for him. So I humbly suggest that we need to think about it in terms of the overall problem. So that being said, one of the other pieces that I think are absolutely important for us to consider is communication. So I have had the great pleasure over the years of participating in several programs specific to multiple offenders, Stop Court. They are programs designed for folks who meet the very criteria that John was talking about, multiple arrests, multiple life issues, mental health concerns. All of these in these programs were well addressed. And the recidivism rates, I believe, reflected upon that. One of the key components of all of these programs is communication. So if I have the opportunity to work with the ADISes, to work with the criminal justice system, so I can let judges know what the heck is going on with my folks when they're doing positive things, but also when they're getting themselves into trouble, this becomes a powerful partnership. So I don't know how we can facilitate that, but from a therapeutic perspective, it's amazing. And then I have a whole piece that I'd love to do about prevention, but I think that's probably beyond the scope of what we're discussing here. I absolutely support John's recommendations about effective evaluation. I think it's really important to tailor treatment to whatever needs are discovered by an individual during the course of your relationship with them. I have had the blessing and privilege of working with people, and at the end of their treatment episode, they tell me that this DUI was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I'm not sure folks like you get to hear that the laws that you're passing, that the consideration that you're giving the problem has the potential of changing people's lives in an amazing way. I don't necessarily think judges get to hear that, nor do police officers. And so we're all on the same team, and I just so appreciate the fact that you're considering what is most effective. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for person? All right. Senator Close first. We'll talk to a lot of people. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. I'll make this brief. Dr. Fitzgerald, I had a question about your cocaine slide, mm-hmm. and you were encouraging us to do longer treatment times based on how long it takes the brain to recover, especially from cocaine on that slide. But because DUII has a number of substances that are contained in that, some are fat soluble, some are water soluble, alcohol water soluble, would the treatment times, wouldn't they differ for what substance you're talking about, and do you have data on that?
You know, we've done a lot of neuroimaging studies, and there's some data on that. I think dropping down into details of specific substances in neuroimaging is kind of missing the point, which there's a lot of other data outside of the neuroimaging that again just suggests that when people have been at it since they were 12, and we also know that they have depression and anxiety and PTSD, that we need to have treatment beyond 3 to 4 months. 3 or 4 months just doesn't cut it. So the neuroimaging is one piece of it. We've done it for alcohol. We've done it for food. We've done it for cocaine. We've done a ton on methamphetamine. It's different for different people. You get into a very technical aspect of neuroimaging and talking about how to define it. But I think the bigger picture of what I'm trying to say is it supports the fact that we need to have, for people that have been at it for a while, they need longer treatment. That's the main point.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you all very much for coming and presenting today. We appreciate that. Judge Jones.
Afternoon. Senator Brzezinski, Representative Krieger, rest of the committee, I really appreciate the chance to come down here and talk to you about some of the background I have in this situation. I've been a trial court judge for 14 years. I ran a public defender office.
Judge Jones, I need you to go ahead and put your name on the
record.
All right,
I'm Edward Jones. There you go. I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County.
Thank you.
And I've been doing that for about 14 years. Before that, I was a public defender. I ran a public defender office for 14 years. And before that, I was a criminal defense lawyer. So I've been litigating DUI cases for almost 40 years. I know, it's shocking. And every year, for almost that entire period of time, for decades, we've sent something like 20,000 people every year to treatment because of a DUI arrest. So over 10 years, that's 200,000 people over, a significant proportion of our community has been through this over the years. And if you think about people spending And there's a lot of different notions about what the right number is, but let's say it costs $1,000. That's probably low to get through treatment. So in the average year, we're sending $20 million a year to treatment programs. Yet today, despite all that treatment money and all the time that's passed and all the offenders who have or haven't recidivated over those years, we still don't have a clue about which treatment programs are most effective or which kinds of treatment are most effective. We don't know really anything about what works for these people. It's time that we started collecting the data that we need to hold the treatment programs and other participants in the system accountable for what they do. When I send offenders to treatment, my goal is to reduce crime. I don't care if they become better people. I just want them to get arrested less often. So my measure of success for treatment is how many times do they get arrested, let's say in the 5 or 10 years after the treatment is over. So some years ago, I said, what about my local treatment programs? Which ones of them have been the most effective at turning out people who don't get arrested again? Nobody had a clue. People have ideas about which programs are better than other programs. If you talk to people, people will tell you, oh, that's better, this better. Lots of opinions, but no data. So then I heard that OHA, or one of its antecedent organizations, actually evaluated treatment programs. And I was like, hooray, give me the data. But it turns out that they don't evaluate the programs on the basis of whether people are getting arrested again. In fact, what the evaluation comes down to is, do you have the right pieces of paper in the right files? End of discussion. Now, OHA does collect data about who's sent to treatment and also about who completes treatment, but where the problem comes is when you try to link that data to criminal justice data. Because OHA, like its antecedents, doesn't collect any identifiers that would allow us to easily link the treatment data with the criminal justice data. Now, the gold standard in criminal justice data is your SID number. You get one when you get booked. Prints, photo, number. Now we got something to work with. And if OHA could collect the SID numbers for all the people who were sent to treatment, it'd be relatively easy to use those numbers to connect their treatment success or failure with their subsequent criminal behavior. So I said, fine, let's get those SID numbers into the OHA data. And as you're, I'm sure, aware, when you get sent to treatment because you're in diversion or you've been convicted, first you go to a screening with an ADIS, an alcohol drug evaluation specialist. I think that's what it means. They interview you, they make a referral to a program, and they send information to OHA. That's where the treatment tracking at OHA starts, is with this form. So we changed the form to include police report numbers, court numbers, and of course SID numbers. So now, in theory, they can take those numbers and just look up the criminal data and start evaluating programs. But of course it wasn't that simple. How does OHA manage all that new data? Well, legacy systems are a problem we all deal with. There is now a new system at OHA, and I'm hopeful it's going to do some of the things that they couldn't do a few years ago. And then how do the ADIS workers get those numbers to put on the forms to send to OHA? Well, that requires cooperation from the court and law enforcement. Some problems there. But then the biggest surprise as I dug into this was is that not everybody gets an SID number. Because quite a few people who get arrested and even convicted of DUI never get booked. So we don't have a way of tracking those people. Now, I'm not surprised that not everybody doesn't get booked at the time of arrest. Police officers stop people. They do what they do. It's not always possible, particularly in the rural areas, to cart that person to jail and get them booked. So even though I'm a big fan of booking them as soon as you catch them, because when you talk about changing people's behavior, the immediacy of being strip searched and booked, nothing replaces that. So it's a very effective tool. But the reality is we're always going to have cite and release because of the realities of law enforcement in our communities. But just because we don't book them when they're arrested doesn't mean we can't book them later, when they're arraigned, when they're sentenced, whenever. There's multiple opportunities. Courts should not allow people to enter diversion or get convicted of DUI without booking them first. And if there's one thing you could do to improve data collection and our long-term ability to understand what works, it would be to get them all booked for sure. Up front, let's do it. Then we can start seriously looking at the data. So, now another big data issue is around our muni courts. Now there's been some, I know there's some recent legislation that's tried to upgrade their data and reporting. Historically, they've had difficulties getting data into the general mix. And they do a significant percentage of our DUI cases. So there's a huge hole around data collection out of the muni court cases. Needs some serious improvement. Now, there is some existing data, and you heard a little bit about it. You know, the DUI data book, I'm sure you've all seen this, and I know your staff has copies. This one ends in 2008, and I was like, why am I not looking at the 2014 version of this? And so I talked to Dan Estes, he's the impaired driving program manager. And I sort of assumed his problem was budgets, right? That's been everybody's problem since 2008. But that's not the case. He told me that they are going to get a new edition out relatively soon, but the problem has been getting necessary data from agency partners. Difficulties. Something that can be fixed. Now, when you look at the 10-year data, the number of second and third subsequent DUIs is roughly, and this is very roughly, 10% of the people who get stopped, cited for drunk driving every year. And when we look at the health data, because the OHA does keep some data, and when I look at their data with help from OHA people, for people who go to treatment and complete it, about 9% of them end up returning to DUI treatment within 5 years. Mm. Now, the OHA is looking just at the treatment data, but that's what we generate out of there. The data book has statewide arrest data. There's also some Multnomah County data that's worth looking at. This document right here, also dated 2008, the Sheriff's Office in Multnomah County did a study of every booking related to a DUI, how long those people sat in jail, why they sat in jail, so on and so forth. If you're thinking about how to use jail to shape behavior of people convicted of DUI, you need to start with this. It's a tremendously interesting document. It has not gotten the attention it deserves. Now, when it comes to DUI, as with other crimes, as legislators, as judges, we preach accountability. But we don't really live it. Because we don't hold ourselves accountable for the results of the decisions we make. And we don't hold the treatment programs accountable for the decisions they make. I mean, I look at treatment as a black box. I mean, it was very interesting to hear the discussions about how treatment works. From my perspective, I don't care what they do. All I want to see is a reduction in the arrests after they come out of the treatment. That's the test that matters, to me anyway. So why not measure them on that basis? But to do it, we need a lot better data collection than we have. And if one thing comes out of this that would pay off would be a really thoughtful approach to how we collect these data, how we track offenders, so that today we don't know the answers. 5 years from now, we'd be in a lot better position to have some answers. So that's my prepared remarks. Happy to deal with any questions anybody has.
Any questions for Judge Jones? Senator Cruz first.
Yeah, more comment, I think. I really liked what you had to say. I ask the health authority for a list of all of the treatment programs in the state of Oregon, both public and private. It took them a fair amount of time to get it to me. There is a lot of them. And I would suggest that a lot of the treatment programs are using the same programs they used 40 years ago, which is a real problem. We are going to have a group of legislators, bicameral, by the way, and bipartisan, party starting in September, taking a hard look at the dollars we spend on treatment and is there a better way to do it? Because I truly believe there is. That doesn't quite speak to where you're going, but because my concern goes beyond whether they're rearrested. My concern goes to whether they can recover their lives.
You know, clearly, I mean, I've been a drug court judge and, you know, worked with people and had the satisfaction of seeing people get better. Mm-hmm. Not in 3 months, generally, and not forever. I mean, I quite endorse what we heard from the two people who spoke before me. But frankly, for me, there's a bright line test for the treatment programs. Either the people they treat are getting less and less often after they're done with them, or they're not.
Yeah. And there is some validity to the length of treatment. When I went, I'm a recovering person. Most people know that. I've been clean 27 years. My treatment was 28 days. At about a year and a half, my head started clearing. So, you know.
We know every program works for some people.
Mm-hmm.
No program works for everybody.
Right.
And, for example, one of the data things I would like to look at, treatment is talking to people when you get down to it at the bottom. Fine. Is it better in a second language? Probably not. But how is treatment done in a second language compared to treatment done in a first language? We should be able to tease that out of the data we had, but it's not really kept in a way that allows you to see that. We all would guess that if you're getting treated in your second language, it's likely to be less effective. But I don't know if that's true or not, but I would like to know because it would shape my view about what treatment programs were best for each particular Russian or Mexican or whatever person that I happen to be dealing with.
Any other questions? Judge, thank you very much.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
All right, that concludes the presentations that we had for the first issue, reducing recidivism rates for DUI offenses. We're going into our second one.
The next item is increasing the rate of aid and assist referrals to the Oregon State Hospital. We'll call Greg Roberts, superintendent, please. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm superintendent at the Oregon State Hospital, and I'm here this afternoon to present information about the what's referred to as the 370 population. That's a reference to the Oregon statute 161.370, under which a court order can be issued to send the defendant to the hospital for treatment so that they are restored to competency, and the generalized phraseology is to the ability to aid and assist in their defense. There's a slide I'll be coming to later to show the visual display of the increase in the population, but I just wanted to cover some definitions first. It's important at the outset to realize when a person is sent to the hospital as a 370 patient, that person does not receive the full range of treatment that we provide to other patients, because the specific goal of the hospital stay is to stabilize that person and restore them to the ability to cooperate with their attorney and to participate in their own defense. So they do receive treatment on they're served by treatment teams, which are defined in the next slide, and they do attend programs on our treatment malls, which I know a number of you on the committee have visited the hospital. You've seen our treatment mall programs. They're basically like a school, a college, where there are multiple classrooms where people spend a good majority of their day receiving treatment. These are the members of the treatment team, psychiatrist, psychologist, social worker, etc. And the treatment malls, as I said, they're centralized locations. Patients generally spend 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, for a total of 20 hours of active treatment. And for 370 patients, the focus is on education about legal skills. They can attend the law library. They receive assistance from our legal staff and, of course, medication management. The treatment, the way the process works in the hospital is the patient receiving treatment is periodically evaluated by certified examiners who determine whether the person is able to aid and assist in their defense. By statute, these evaluations take place at the 30-day point after admission, then 90 days after, and then every 180 days after that. The evaluations can occur more quickly if the treatment team signals our forensic evaluation certified evaluators that the person, they've come to a decision or recommendation already as to whether the person falls into these categories. The determination that the person is now able and to stand trial, to proceed with their legal process. And in that case, if a person is judged to be able now to be competent to return, then they return to jail and they proceed. Or the second option is that the person is not yet able, meaning that the team and the forensic evaluators believe the person will be able to, at some point in the future, regain the ability to aid and assist in their defense, and that person would remain at the hospital for treatment until they reach the point that they are able. And then the third option is that the person is never able, meaning that the team believes this person will never be able to regain competency, or at least in the foreseeable future. And in those cases, the court would either dismiss the charge and order that the person be discharged from the hospital, or the court would could recommend that civil commitment procedures begin. But it's important to know that that rarely happens, and it's a sign of something that I'd like to talk about in this presentation, that the 370 patients who come to the hospital are, for the most part, 90%, 90 to 95% of these people do not meet the involuntary commitment, civil commitment standard. Seen in the fact that for the 370 patients, only of 389 discharges last year, only 9 came back to the hospital as civil committees. That's 2.3%. So the other 97.7% people moved through the criminal justice system or were discharged to the community. This slide is a summary of people who were treated at the hospital in 2013. As you can see, the large majority of the patients were determined able to participate. participate in their legal process, aid and assist their defense attorney, and they left the hospital and went back to jail to proceed through the system. 57 were never declared never able, and there were 57 others, which confused me when I saw the slide. It's one or the other, but these other 57 people represent people whose charges were dropped before the process was completed, or who reached the end of the time that their sentence would carry before we could complete the 370 evaluation process. In terms of length of stay, the statute permits people to remain in the hospital for up to 3 years on a 370 order, or to the point of the maximum sentence that the court could have imposed if the defendant had been convicted, whichever is shorter. So 3 years is the absolute maximum. In 2013, the average length of stay for a 370 patient was 107 days, and the median, 50% above, 50% below, was 71 days. And as we'll discuss, I'm sure, later, the cost per month for a hospital stay for a 370 patient is about $25,000. So if you multiply, the top figure is 3 months, the second figure is about 2.5 months. It's a pretty sizable cost. This slide shows it's a snapshot of the patient population at the hospital on May 1st in terms of length of stay. As you see, the bulk of the patients are 6 months or less, and there are a few patients 6 months or longer. Two patients have been 370 patients for more than 2 years. And this is the slide I was referring to earlier that shows the trend since 2010 in the population. The top part of the slide is the number of patients in the hospital on 370 orders. As you can see, from 2010 to April 2014, the number of 370 patients in the hospital has doubled. The bottom figure shows the number of admissions, which that line tends to be closer to the trend line, but as you can see, for seven or eight of the last 12 months, the number of admissions has also been above the trend line. Then in combination with those facts, what we're seeing is a change in the mix of patients who come to the hospital. And we're specifically interested to focus on people who are misdemeanants in the hospital. So I don't think I mentioned already that two-thirds of the people admitted to the state hospital last year were admitted under a 370 aid and assist order. Two-thirds of all of the admissions to the hospital. Of those admissions, about 60% were felonies and about 40% were misdemeanors. So interesting figures and of concern that so many people coming into the hospital are now not civilly committed or even guilty except for insanity patients, which a few years back we would not have been able to say. There's been good progress in developing community programs for people who are guilty except for insanity. So the number of guilty except for insanity patients in the hospital has been decreasing. The number of patients in the hospital who are civilly committed has been stable, and the number of geriatric patients in the hospital has actually decreased, and we closed one of our geriatric wards last year. But that has been offset by the increase in the 370 population.
May I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So, Greg, so has the number of misdemeanor admittance for 370s, has that increased over the years?
Chairman and Representative Tomei, yes. The percentage of 370 patients who are misdemeanors has been increasing. It used to be a 70-30 division between felonies and misdemeanors. Now it's about 60-40.
Thank you.
Please continue.
A few years ago, I think 2 years ago, House Bill 3100 was passed relevant to the 370 statute, and that that law standardized psychiatric evaluation processes and set new parameters for the credentials of people who can do the forensic evaluations, and it gave courts more flexibility and control over where such individuals could be treated, especially when they're accused of a nonviolent crime. So according to that law, the courts can commit people to the state hospital under the 370 statute if they are a danger to themselves or others, or if the services and supports they need are not available in the community. And that second bullet is the essential point, we feel, that people are coming under the 370 statute as misdemeanants into the state hospital as a reflection of the fact that services they could benefit from do not exist or do not exist in sufficient quantity in the community. So therein lies the answer, we believe. In terms of steps, and I should preface this by saying, what we're doing to the various audiences that we're speaking is mostly a description of the problem. We have been working hard ever since this trend line began to significantly increase last year, work to identify the root causes of the problem. I think it's a theme. Yesterday at some hearings I went to and here today, we don't want to hypothesize as to what the issue is. We want to know from the data what the issues are so we don't end up chasing inappropriate solutions. So we have been in regular conversations with local law enforcement officials, with criminal justice system, with county mental health providers. We have formed a work group in Marion County, a good collaborative group that I think Rod coming behind me will talk more about, but with defense attorneys, judges, advocates, staff from the state hospital, looking at the population from Marion County, which is our second highest admitting county for 370s, to begin to understand why this trend is occurring and what we may be able to do about it. And then we're also looking at, there is a provision within House Bill 3100, as I said, for a person to be referred to community-based restoration services and the funding that would be required to facilitate, so that people would not be coming to the state hospital for restoration services when, in fact, they could benefit from those services if they were provided in the community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Greg, looking at the trend lines on the number 11, that it has doubled in the number since January 10 of patients coming in under the 370. So what will be the effect if this continues? How much will the hospital have to enlarge?
Thank you, and Chairman and Representative Tomei, members of the committee. We have already seen and experienced in the hospital, as this trend line continues to rise, we have already had to convert two units within the hospital to become 370 units. We don't like to mix our patient populations and have 370 patients with civil committees or with the GEI patients. So we have already converted two units to 370 units, and it's about every 6 months, if this trend line continued without change, then every 6 months we would have to add another 370 unit to the hospital, and that actually can't be done, obviously, ad infinitum. You reach a point where there just isn't the room for this. And I should mention one fact that I didn't mention. Under the statute, when a court order is signed to send a person to the state hospital under the 370 statute, we must admit that person within 7 days. So we cannot create a wait list for 370 patients. And that's designed so that people who need mental health treatment are not languishing in jail for long periods of time. So, and that's also part of the issue. So,
thank you, if I may. So we passed House Bill 3100. Representative Senator Brzezinski, you were involved in that, and maybe you were too, Mr. Chair. We were trying to decrease the number of people coming into the hospital and increase the number of people leaving the hospital, and you've been able to do that with many of your patients, PSRB and the elderly and the disabled.
Correct.
But I don't think there was any implication at that time that the 370s would be increasing. And so remind us again how much that is per year for these patients, the 370s?
Representative, at the rate of $25,000 a month, 1 year, we come to $300,000 per patient.
So almost a third of $1 million per patient per year. And I know we've dealt with seclusion and restraint both in this committee and in the human services. Can you tell us what these new patients, what effect they have on
your seclusion? Chairman and Representative Tomei and members of the committee, we find we have created, as I said, discrete units in the hospital for the 370 patients. They correlated, we maintain data all the time for patient aggression, patient-to-patient aggression, patient-to-staff aggression, use of seclusion, use of restraints, and our data is highest on those, on the 370 units. There's more aggression on those units leading to more seclusion, more restraint.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gimbel.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I have a couple of questions. First, just following up on that, the discrete unit. So are the people who are there for misdemeanors together with the people who are there for felonies?
Senator,
or are they kept separate?
No, they are grouped. We, in the past year, we've actually made an attempt to group the patients by county. We have not been able to do that 100% across the board. And we've done that so that our treatment teams can form more direct relationships with the community providers and the jails in the particular counties. But we don't generally mix people according to felonies or misdemeanors.
And is that a problem? I mean, would there be some benefit to keeping them separate? Or, you know, as you look at where there's the most violence, do they tend to be in the felony population? Or
Chairman and Senator Dembro, it's a good question. I haven't seen any data on that, but that could be worth looking into. Part of the problem, if I could add, is that because the numbers are so high, it can be difficult to have the patient, the bed available for the patient that fits best. So sometimes people are admitted to a particular unit and then have to wait for a bed to be vacant on another unit to have them where we actually want them to be. So two of the units are gender specific, but one of the units really is gender specific in terms of an all-female unit.
Thank you. I did have another question. Going back to the demographics, so, you know, presumably some counties are better equipped to, accommodate people who are otherwise sent to the state hospital. So do you see, demographic variation among the people there for 370s? And I'm kind of curious as to why Marion County is number two.
I have that data. I'm just looking for the chart. There are six counties in particular account for the highest numbers, but I think those probably correlate with people with the highest population. So it's Multnomah County, Marion County, Washington County, Lane, and Douglas and Klamath are the top six counties.
Thank you. So, Greg, a couple of things. On your slide 12, which is the 0.370 patient admissions.
Yes.
Do you know if those numbers reflect what I'm going to call dual offenses, or are they separate primary offenses? In other words, if someone's listed here as a felony, could they also be listed there as a misdemeanor?
Senator Przanski, yes. But they're listed by the highest offense. So if a person has three felony charges and a misdemeanor, then they're showing here as a felony.
Okay. So the misdemeanors that are listed here, you're saying that's their primary offense? There's no felonies?
That's correct.
Okay. Second, the cost of the services. It's my understanding there's an obligation if there are state court referrals that the state would be picking up the tab, as compared to if it's a county or municipal court, those jurisdictions actually have to pay for those services. Is that correct?
Senator Przanski, not to my knowledge. I don't. We charge for this very small fee charge for cost of the forensic evaluations, but the cost of care actually is part of the hospital's budget, mainly general fund.
Could you please provide us with that? Because I know in the courts I practice in, that they are hesitant to send someone to the state hospital because of the cost. So I'm not sure what cost they're hesitating over, if it's just an evaluation cost or if it's more than just that. And then the other part, which is the one that is on slide 13 and carries over, I guess, to slide 14, do you believe that the 370 patients would have the ability to have the services necessary if they were, in fact, referred to, I'm going to call it one of the local HB 3100 facilities? Because what I heard you saying as to what is provided to a 370 patient, I'm wondering if those other local facilities are able to do what is necessary to comply with the law for evaluations for aid and assist.
Senator Prezanski, members of the committee, there are some existing services. There are some counties that have small programs. I think, again, Rod can describe Marion County as he did yesterday. They are small in number, and they generally cannot serve large numbers of people, but that is a demonstration of the fact that people, especially misdemeanors, we're trying to keep the argument focused on misdemeanors, that people can be restored to the ability to aid and assist in the community. They come to the state hospital because there's not sufficient services in the community, or they refuse to participate in the services that do exist, which is part of the problem.
Right. My last question, Mr. Chair,
please,
is on your slide 5 on the treatment malls, and it talks about examples of 0.370 groups. Am I to take away from this that when they're in the facility, that the state hospital is providing them, quote-unquote, some type of training on legal skills, use of a law library, legal assistance as part of their evaluation to determine whether they are able to aid and assist?
Senator Prezanski, yes, that would be correct. That we have staff who, it's not legal advice, it's education about the legal system, how the legal system works. People in the law library have the ability to research statutes, and there are attorneys assigned to the hospital who are available to them for legal guidance. The hospital staff do not provide legal guidance to them, but we educate them about the system and try to prepare them to be able to aid and assist their attorney.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would just ask, so it seems like you're getting all these more misdemeanor people. Is it because they just don't want to leave them on the street? I mean, I'm watching and reading the paper and online because they only print a couple days a week anymore. But I see so many people are never sentenced to anything other than probation. I mean, I'm watching a guy who was boarding his hash and oil and burned down a house, and he's an ex-con with a firearm, probation. So why are misdemeanants who probably are really not facing jail time ending up in the state hospital?
Representative Barker, members of the committee, that's part of the question we're researching as to why this trend. If you look at the trend line, you do see at a certain point in 2013 the line starts to rise, and we don't want to hypothesize about that. There was a state that question came up at the committee yesterday, and part of the answer was that defense attorneys may be more and more inclined now to cover that base, to see that, you know, to make sure they represent their client appropriately, to have the evaluation done to see if mental illness is a factor in the commission of their crime.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Do you have a breakdown between those who are incapable and those who refuse, incapable of assisting themselves and those who refuse? I mean, do you have those numbers broken out? That would be an interesting...
Senator, I don't have those numbers. I can have our legal affairs department work on that. I would say for the... in my experience, I would say the large majority would be people for whom the services don't exist in sufficient quantity in the community, not so much the services exist and they refuse to participate. But both factors are there.
Yeah, I mean, these are things driving costs that are worth taking a look at. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for your presentation. It's really compelling and troubling information, and I sense that you share concern that $300,000 a year would be spent to house someone who's potentially guilty of a misdemeanor, but maybe not, because there isn't a community-based alternative in that community where they can be served. You know, I feel like people are speaking to that issue here on the panel, but it is really profound, and I know the Human Services Committee yesterday was really moved by the fact that if we're looking to make highest and best use of our scarce public dollars, heck, $300,000 to keep someone who may or may not be guilty of a misdemeanor in an extremely sophisticated facility sure seems like reason for us to take pause and think about how we can do things better. So thank you.
Any further questions?
I agree.
Any further questions?
One clarification.
Please.
Speaking of the misdemeanors, so you got three different levels of misdemeanors. Class A is up to a year that they could be jailed. B's are 6 months, I think, for C's are 30 days. So if they hit those dates, they're released. So if someone, I mean, I don't know who's coming in as the misdemeanors, but the only reason that you would see potentially someone staying for a year in the facility if they're charged with a Class A misdemeanor, such as assault in the fourth degree, domestic violence.
Right. Senator President, as one of the slides shows, I would say the majority, the average length of stay is 107 days, the median is 70 days, so very few 370 patients remain in the hospital for as long as a year. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I mean, there's not more serious than this.
Mr. Crockett,
yes.
Please.
Sounds like.
Yeah. I'm Chair Barker, members of the committees. Good afternoon. I'm Rod Calkins. I'm the administrator at the Marion County Health Department. The health department provides community mental health services to a lot of the folks involved with the Aid and Assist or 370 group that Superintendent Roberts just described. We've been working very carefully with the Oregon State Hospital, law enforcement, and the courts around this issue for some time now. I'm going to take a little bit of time to talk about what we've done, but mostly to talk a little bit about the work group that has just been recently convened, I think, that Superintendent Roberts mentioned. Back in 2007, Marion County joined three other counties, Lane, Multnomah, and Douglas, in an initial pilot to try and reduce the aid and assist population at the state hospital. And we had some initial encouraging success, because by 2010, our numbers in Marion County had dropped into single digits, which was lower than where we started. And what we did in that time that seemed to make a difference was provide case management to individuals in the judicial system. We made psychiatric prescribing available for individuals in crisis. We built some transitional, well, we bought some transitional housing and helped people in applying for benefits. We also worked with the hospital to transition people out of the hospital more quickly and hook them up with community resources. Unfortunately, come 2011, our numbers parallel the slide you saw from Superintendent Roberts. They've gone up steeply, and it is now not uncommon for our numbers to be over 20.
20. Excuse me, could I ask a question?
Yes.
Is that 20 a month, 20 a year, 20?
That's 20 at any given time.
Thank you.
And our length of stay would be fairly parallel to what you saw in terms of the means and medians.
Thank you.
Okay. So the piece we're most excited about right now is we're involved in a collaborative work group, and I think you heard some of the participants, but it's basically everybody involved in the aid and assist process from Marion County, the state hospital. And the goal is to decrease the overcrowding at the state hospital, but really to serve as a model, perhaps, for how other communities might address this issue as well. As you know, every part of Oregon's a bit different, so instead of just a blueprint, we will have a template that people can pick and choose from. I want to point out that aid and assist is first and foremost a legal process and is usually triggered by the defense attorney. And community mental health has no authority within that courtroom to determine whether that defense is appropriate or correct. So one of the things we found is it's a bit difficult for us to partner in this endeavor because, well, for example, it's possible that if we got too involved, mental health got too involved in the court system, we could be seen as hindering a person's defense or hindering the prosecution. So I think one of the things we grapple with is how can our knowledge about the person be brought to bear appropriately to help make that person successful in their restoration to fitness. And that's a tough one. And that's one of the things we're working on. So once a person's determined unable to aid and assist in their defense, the judge can enact a 370 order and have somebody receive restorative treatment at the state hospital. But as Superintendent Roberts mentioned, that can also be done in the community when appropriate. In 2013, Marion County provided community restoration services to 12 individuals. And so far in 2014, we've served 8. So compared to the total numbers of 74 last year and 79 so far this year, 79 last year, that's a fairly low number when you think that unlike the overall average of 40-some percent being misdemeanors, about 50% of the folks coming from Marion County are there on misdemeanor charges. One of the questions was, why is Marion County perhaps second? And I think that's a good one. And I think one of the things that we've looked at is about 15 to 20% of the folks coming up on a 370 from Marion County come from another state institution and are not necessarily Marion County residents. So that's one of the differences of Marion County here is we have a lot of state institutions. One of the things that we've recognized is that it's really important for people to have good information early on about what people need in terms of restorative treatment, what kind of mental health issues may be there that need to be addressed. And one of the best ways of doing that is to get a community mental health evaluation or consult with mental health folks like our jail mental health people who know something about the defendant. And when we looked at the cases going up from Marion County about a year ago, about 50% of folks. Now, this isn't the psychiatric competency evaluation that Superintendent Roberts referred to. This is information about a person's mental health state that helps the court make a decision about a 370. When we looked a year ago, about 50% of the people who were issued a 370 order did not have a mental health evaluation prior to that. We've been working with the courts, and recently the numbers have improved. More people have been getting an evaluation and consultation, but still about 25% don't have one. So that's one area where we're thinking we can improve the system. It's more an issue of informed decision making there. I want to say just one thing that's not directly related to what you do for a 370, but it has to do with thinking about what's the best way for us to invest in services that may help. And that is, in Marion County, we've had a great collaboration between law enforcement, courts, corrections, the DA's office, and health for a number of years now. And what we're doing is looking upstream to preventative or pre-adjudicative activities that really ought to keep the person from getting into that courtroom where you have to make a 370 decision. And so those are things like crisis intervention training for law enforcement, treatment courts, mental health, drugs treatment, vets courts, mental health services in the jail diversion that we've just recently started, mobile crisis outreach, which we had some investment dollars from the Oregon Health Authority just started recently. We have two teams now in the field that pair an officer from the Sheriff's Department or Salem Police Department with a mental health specialist. They're riding around the cars together. They take calls that involve mental health cases. Over the last 2 weeks, we've had 70 calls that have been responded to. That's how great the needs. So these are all things that have yet to be proved in terms of how much impact they will have downstream on the thing we're talking about. But I would encourage you to think that there ought to be some attention paid to that upstream preventative activities and encourage those in communities to do that. So I'll close with kind of the most promising piece. The work group has really come up with a lot of ideas. You have a handout, I think, that lists a number of those recommendations or thoughts that we're looking at. But the key piece I'd leave you with is that the most important thing is we're working on this together. We're all in the same room, and we're all committed to solving this problem.
Yes, two things. First of all, Rod, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think Phoenix, Arizona is one of the leading departments using that team approach, and they've done that for decades. So if you're looking for how that has worked in the sense of what the actual data shows, I think that would be someplace you may want to look. I know there's other departments around the country that have done it too. I guess the one thing that struck me in your presentation is that currently there are referrals to the state hospital as a 370 without the court first being informed as to some type of local evaluation being done?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, it seems to me that how can a court be informed to make that referral to the state hospital without having someone at the local level giving the court that informed that information to inform them?
Well, there obviously are some evaluations being done at the local level, and there are more of them now. But yes, the statute does not require that the court have an evaluation or order an evaluation before issuing a 370 order.
Now, I know that there are some that do, but it sounds to me what your experience is that maybe that percentage of those that aren't is much higher or greater than what maybe most people thought.
It's probably more than was anticipated. In some way, 50% was quite high. We worked with a couple of the judges who agreed that they would seek information about the person's mental status. The other issue I would raise is that some of the evaluations we have looked at have contained diagnoses such as malingering and dangerous and recommended placement in the state hospital. And there's no indication there of a mental health involvement. And my understanding is that's not consistent with the intent of the statute. So one of the things the work group's looking at is putting in place a screening process right when the person comes up to the hospital to assess for that. If it's just substance abuse, no mental health, or if it's just malingering, which isn't a mental health diagnosis, that's when people feign an illness, usually for some gain, then that person really isn't meeting the 370 criteria, and we need to clean that up, I think. That's one of the things that we need to look at. And I think that we're looking at how we could improve the assessment process as well as doing that that screening.
Thank you.
But those are some of the early ideas, and we can report back sometime on how they worked out.
And I have a question on that. So it just seems like so a lawyer is going to do the best job they can, and I don't think they'd be accepted, but if the client's telling them, I'm suffering from post-traumatic stress, and maybe they're a veteran or not, I mean, people have that all over the place. So then they make the application then that this crime he just committed may be because of that, we need to have it evaluated, and they end up in state hospital. Is it that easy, or is it I mean, the judge doesn't, the judge is not going to want to send somebody to jail if they're mentally ill.
Right.
I mean, if that's what caused the crime.
And I think Bob Jinduff, who's up next, could probably talk to you more about what's going through the defense attorney's mind. But I think one of the things, if you're representing somebody, you're required to give them their best effort in a defense. And if you try to talk to them and they are not making sense to you, what's that about, I think, is the question that goes through your head. And if that might be the result of a mental illness, should you not be using this defense?
And
most of the defense attorneys I've talked to, they're looking at this as possibly a way of getting people into treatment in a system that doesn't have a lot of resources or access to treatment, or people that haven't been willing to enter treatment any other way. I think we have to do a lot better job of engaging people in the community system upstream, rather than waiting till we get to that point and having a defense attorney faced with that kind of decision.
Sure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure.
This isn't really a question. I guess it's sort of a statement. I think some of us have been involved with the USDOJ when they first came to investigate the state and our treatment of the mentally ill, and especially of the state hospital. So now we have a new state hospital, and we're filling it up with people who've committed misdemeanors. And I think this is not at all what we intended in 2011 when we passed the bill regarding admissions to the state hospital. One of the things the USDOJ is continuing to say to us is that we are not sufficient in our community services. And they were very concerned when we built the second hospital in Junction City. And they were saying, you're doing this, but you're still not providing the kind of crisis services and the community mental health services we need. And because of this, this is why we're seeing these people are committing misdemeanors rather than them sending to treatment in their own community. Even malingerers, I mean, that is so offensive to me. They go in as malingerers, they come out as malingerers. It's not saying that they're mentally ill. It's saying they're trying to fool you so they don't have to go to the county jail or whatever. This is so offensive, and it's so counterproductive to the requirements that the USDOJ is making of our state. And it's costing us almost $250,000 a year per person. And we're increasing that population. When are we going to build another hospital? Is the USDOJ going to be coming to our state to take over our mental health system? Something has to be done, and we need to make some changes quickly. And I'm very disappointed that we don't have defense attorneys here speaking to us today, why they're sending people to the state hospital. I'm very disappointed that we don't have judges telling us why they're sending people to the state hospital. I'm very disappointed that we don't have an explanation of why 50% of the individuals sent to the state hospital have not had an examination. I can't believe that we are at this state, after we've been working on this issue for so many years, to come to this point. How did we get here, and how the heck are we going to get out of here? That was my question, Mr. Chair, but thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say for the record, because it's a very rare thing, I agree with Representative.
I thought you would.
Yeah. Okay, further questions?
Chair Parker? Yeah, sure. I might respond to that just
briefly.
Yeah,
please.
I think the question was asked earlier about what misdemeanors, ABC, were we seeing as part of the aid and assist. And I think that's an important question because for some of those, there's person-on-person menacing as well as assault. Those are issues of public safety. Sometimes the charge on which somebody is going up to the state hospital is one of a long history of charges, and the DAs don't feel comfortable about having that person restored in the community without the issue of public safety being addressed. So we do need to be attentive to that, and we are working on that within the work group.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Then? So what happened to these same people, 5 or 10 years ago? What happened to those people when they weren't being sent to the state hospital for misdemeanors?
I think we've seen a lot of the folks in jail, and languishing in jail is something we need to avoid, too.
This community, the state hospital, is almost as bad.
Yeah. I would agree.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask?
Yes, Senator Dimrow.
Yes, thank you. So going back to the pilot project, where you had initial success, just to clarify, there was initial success up to about 2010, and then by 2011 you weren't seeing that anymore. What do you account for to create that decline? What had changed? Was it tied to the economy? Was it tied to resources out in the community? What changed?
I think there's a lot of speculation, and those are good ones, Senator Dembrough. I wouldn't want to speculate on what the exact one is. I mean, that is really one of the things our work group, as Superintendent Roberts said, that's what we're working on, because we'd like to know, because that speaks to the root cause of it. There was a statutory change in 2011. The aid and assist 370 evaluations and defense had been there for a while, and people kind of might have been awakening to it. I mean, there's a lot of things along with economy and other things like that.
Thanks. This really is a question. So are you able to get any Medicaid funding in your programs, Dr. Calkins? Are you able to get Medicaid money for some of your mental health programs in your county?
Yes, we do get quite a bit of Medicaid money for funding. Oftentimes the folks we're talking about are not Medicaid eligible if they've been incarcerated or in hospital, and it takes time to restart those. So things like suspension of benefits while incarcerated would be very helpful. We have people who actually help people restart their benefits or apply for the first time, and that's one of the keys of moving some of that funding burden to Medicaid.
Yeah, but that's a federal issue.
Yes.
And one final question. So is the state hospital, to your knowledge, are they able to get Medicaid funding for their patients?
I believe that is not funded by Medicaid. I think it's all state general fund. And so it's
thank
that
you.
Much more expensive.
Okay. And just thank you very much. And just a quick numbers. You said you keep about 20 people from Marion County. That's $6 million a year.
Yeah.
So.
It's a staggering figure.
Yeah,
yes, it is.
Okay, thank you very much. And
thank
I'm going to go out of schedule just very briefly for a few minutes. Gail Myers here from the defense attorneys, and so like 2 or 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Lawyers Association. Just wanted to make one clarifying point, if I could, about the role of the defense lawyer in a position like this. The attorney ethically cannot dispose of the case if they really honestly believe that their client is unfit. So that's different than having a criminal case where a client's mentally ill, but fit, able to aid and assist you. When your client really is not able to aid and assist in their own defense, the defense lawyer cannot move forward with the case. The defense lawyer cannot assist in resolving the allegation. So yesterday, Representative Tomei, before the House Human Services, the question was posed by Representative Gelser, why are public urination cases ending up in the state hospital when a college kid might be charged with the same thing and never spend a night in jail? That's because the lawyer can go to the college kid and say, buddy, take the violation, do your community service, and get the heck out of here. But you can't, as the lawyer, help your client resolve that case if the client is unfit and incapable of aiding and assisting in their own defense. So the logjam then becomes, if you can't get fit in the community because there are no services, there's really two options. The DA dismisses, or they have to go to the hospital. It's that way.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So it seems to me the operative word, if there are no services, community health services in the community, is that correct?
Representative Tomei, I do think that's it, because on a misdemeanor level, with some of those crimes that Director Roberts was listing off that they're going in for, they're minor public nuisance offenses. Mm-hmm. People who are chronically, seriously mentally ill do pose a public nuisance.
Right.
But if you're going to address the issue penologically through the criminal justice system and the client truly is unfit and cannot assist the lawyer cannot proceed and resolve the case. They don't have the ethical capacity to do that.
No. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob Junedep, please.
Chair
Chair Brzezinski and Chair Barker. My name is Bob Junda. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you very much for inviting me to talk. I think most of my testimony has already been given because the people who have testified before you and people on your committees are very knowledgeable about this area. And so I don't want to repeat things that folks have already said, and I know that you'll direct me if that is the case. What I would like to, I think, talk about is that my testimony is from the patient rights perspective. I'm sitting on the work group in Marion County right now, so and that's been thoroughly covered by Rod Calkins. I think probably the best thing that I can bring to you is the perspective of actually working with you over the last few years on this problem, because this is the problem of the state hospital and how the state hospital is used has been something that's been before the legislature for years and years. And when we last convened, in a sense, was around House Bill 3100, when we were tackling the problem of how we can most effectively use state hospital beds, with the knowledge that they're expensive, that they're a precious resource, and that we should use them thoughtfully. And it's difficult to do that in some ways because we demand many different things from the state hospital. In this case, we have the intersection of the criminal justice system that has a particular mindset, and as Ms. Meyer noted, certain ethical obligations by the people who work in that system and certain constitutional obligations to make sure that people are not unconstitutionally adjudicated when they don't know what the heck's going on, because that's just like being tried in absentia. But also making sure that the hospital is the right place to help a person, to evaluate what a person's needs are and get them back on track so that they can face charges. And just to maybe state the obvious is that that role is different than providing the type of mental health treatment that a person may need in terms of inpatient treatment that is designed to return them to an effective and productive life in the community. That's not the purpose of that commitment. That commitment is just to get a person capable of understanding what their lawyer is talking about, understand what a judge is doing, send them back to jail. And part of what we see as a result of years and years and years of underfunded community mental health services and systems that have been not supported in our communities is that we've seen the criminalization of mental illness, where people end up in jail, they end up being arrested, they end up with contact with law enforcement. They get brought into jails where sheriffs aren't very well equipped to handle their needs. Some jails more so, some less. And then people, because of this process of aid and assist, move to the hospital. If successful, move back to the jail, where there can be very lengthy delays in terms of the resolution of their criminal justice problems. And we've talked about in the past, sometimes people then returning to the hospital again because they've decompensated in jail and coming back. So it's an inefficient system. We looked at this all very carefully when we looked at House Bill 3100, and I thought we did great work on that bill, because we said, you know, we have two groups of people we want to look at. We want to look at people who have used the insanity defense, and so they've been sent to the hospital because they've been found guilty except for insanity. And we've got this other group of people who haven't even gotten to the point of being adjudicated because they don't understand what's going on in court. I think that we've done very, very well in terms of that group of people who have been adjudicated. In fact, I was just meeting with Juliet Follansby from the PSRB this morning and talking about her successes in being able to oversee folks in the community safely and effectively who are under PSRB jurisdiction. But in the aid and assist area, we have not succeeded. and we're and so I have a few quick suggestions on that score, and I will just actually, I thought I would just go down the statute and talk about where I see the pinch points are and things for your consideration. So the statute that affects evaluations to determine whether a person's fit is ORS 161-365. And when we modified that statute, one of the things we did not modify back in our earlier shot was that we still left evaluations, the use of evaluations as being discretionary with the court. And so we can continue under law to have a court send a person or make a finding of inability to aid and assist without any type of formal evaluation. And of course what that means is that the efforts that we went to in 3100 to create trained and certified evaluators so that we can have more consistency and effectiveness in terms of evaluation never comes into play if a court chooses not to use an evaluation. We also thought that it would be more effective in most cases if evaluations could happen locally so that there wasn't the process of a person being ordered to have an evaluation in the state hospital and then wait sometimes weeks, and it can be months, it literally can be months. Once a judge is ordered that a person be transported to the state hospital, that happens. And then have them have an evaluation at the state hospital then sent back. We haven't succeeded in having the resources and funding available so that those evaluations can happen locally, which means if we did, they would happen more quickly. They would have been by a certified evaluator, and we wouldn't have people languishing weeks and months before getting an evaluation, and then literally weeks and months after having an evaluation, because again, there is no timeline in state law in terms of how quickly things have to move in that process. Superintendent Roberts was correct that once a person has been found unable to aid and assist, the hospital has to take them within 7 days, and that's a matter of constitutional law. But in that entire evaluation process, there are no timelines, and that's something that would be very effective, I think, in taking a look at, because as you can imagine, if a person does have a serious mental illness, that sitting in jail for months waiting for some form of effective treatment, I believe, means that by the time they hit that hospital for treatment, they're going to be one of those people who is going to increase the restraint need. They're going to be more violent. That means more injuries to staff who have to deal with those problems. And as you know, because those staff have been here to talk to you about violent patients,
Mr. Junior,
they need the support.
In ORS 161-365, procedure for determining issue of fitness to proceed, there is a limit of 30 days. They committed for the purpose of an examination for a period not exceeding 30 days to the state hospital or the facility.
Representative Barker, and that's for people who've been sent to the hospital. So once the person arrives at the hospital, there is a time frame. So if I was sent to the hospital for evaluation, they can only keep me in OSH for 30 days. But they can keep me for quite a long time in jail waiting to get to the hospital. And then after my evaluation, I can stay in jail waiting resolution of my charges. So
I think there's a finite part here, though, because if they're not brought before the court and they just sit in jail, I understand that argument. But once the court deems they're supposed to go up, there's a 7-day requirement for the hospital to take them. Once they get them at the hospital, they have another 30 days. So basically you have within 37 days that everything should be completed. But I understand, working with the defense attorney, they may try to discuss these issues with their client while they're sitting in jail for some period of time before they bring the motion and have the hearing That's what you're referring to as this period of time.
Actually, Senator Przanski, the 7 days that Representative Superintendent Roberts was referring to is post finding that a person.
Yeah, that's what I just said.
It's
the reality. What you're referring to is once they've been arrested, before they actually have that adjudication that they need to go to the hospital for this evaluation for aid and assist, that is the time frame you're talking about.
That period of time, as well as when a person is returned to jail. So the superintendent certifies that the person is able to aid and assist,
right.
or never able to aid and assist. We've talked about never-nevers. There is no time frame by which that the court then has to make a finding and proceed with the case. So we have situations in which people have sat in jail 8 months to almost a year after having been determined by the hospital never able to aid and assist, sent back to jail, but then the court never adjudicates the case.
Well,
so these are some time frames that I just thought I would bring to your attention.
I appreciate that, but I've just got to say with Gail Myers here, if a defense attorney is not bringing this up to the court after their client has been returned and said never able for 6-8 months, then it seems to me we have another problem here. And I don't think that's happening. It would just seem to me that those attorneys would be immediately getting this back before the court and saying, we now have the certification from the state hospital, this person's never going to be able to be fit, and then the court's going to deal with it. I find it hard to believe that in this day and time, in this state, that we would have people return from the state hospital, sitting there for 6 to 8 months before they get some type of final disposition based on a never going to be able to aid and assist. If that's happening, I would like to know that for the Judiciary Committee.
That's why I'm bringing it to your attention, Senator Przanski.
I'd like to have some cases. I'd like to actually have the actual cases where this is happening.
Happy to do that. On the payment matter that was brought up earlier, I'm just, again, moving through the statute, the payment that the locality has to take care of is the evaluation payment.
Okay.
Rather than the cost of hospitalization. And so whether there might be some hesitancy to get one of those evaluations because it would cost the public defense budget or the county budget, I don't have any data or factual information about that, but that's where the cost comes into play.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So tell me about the evaluation. It's not somebody being in the hospital for aid and assist. It's not that total evaluation all that time that they'd be in the hospital. This is a particular evaluation that you're referring to?
Representative Tomei, I'm not sure I understand the question.
You say the local communities only have to pay for the evaluation. They don't have to pay for their total time in the state hospital.
That is correct.
And the evaluation is exactly what?
That would be a local evaluation to determine fitness.
Locally.
Yeah.
The local person. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I've hit upon the key areas where I think that the statute could be looked at. One of the excellent things that I thought that we wrote into House Bill 3100 was the ability of the state hospital to assess a person's dangerousness as well as their ability to assist their attorney. And we built in a provision that says that if the hospital, either the court at the initial period of determination of inability or the hospital finds that a person is not dangerous but is in need of treatment, that person can be moved into community services even though their criminal charges are still in abeyance. And that is an excellent idea, but in order for that idea to succeed, there have to be adequate community services. And And what Mr. Calkins is talking about in terms of developing those services are exactly what needs to happen if we're going to be able to succeed in implementing what Hospital 3100 has laid out as a possibility. The good news is that the types of services we're talking about, which are wraparound type services, ACT team services, supported housing services, crisis intervention services, are things that the Addictions and Mental Health Division have been putting out contracts for recently as part of their response to the U.S. Department of Justice demand that the state be doing more in the provision of community services in order to control the population of the state hospital. So in my mind, this is a piece of that larger puzzle. If we can get those services in place, it's important that they be available to the hospital so that people who do not pose a danger to society can be moved into more appropriate community services. I'd asked Rod if about the people who he sees these days who are coming through through this process, and whether they're people that are known to him or they're new people. And what he told me was that most of the people are new. So they're not folks who have been traditionally served by the community mental health system. They're people who have been living and working in the community. Something's happened in their lives or some sort of situation. They end up in a criminal offense allegation, and here we go. And so that's a new person that's coming to the mental health system, both the state system and potentially the community mental health system. And in my mind, this is a fantastic opportunity if a person has those needs to hook them into services, because as I said, and I guess I'll try to whet your appetite for the possibilities here, but one of the real challenges, as you know, is those people in the community who need mental health services, who benefit from mental health services, but they're not hooked into those services. And once we have identified somebody who's needing them, it's a fantastic opportunity to have it, to try to move them into the types of services that would benefit them in the future. Rather than the scenario in which a person just gets cut loose because they have been brought in, found unable, and then just go off without any discharge planning, any supports, and tie into a community system. So this really offers us an opportunity for transition. And when you think about the types of people who in our communities who may potentially pose danger but don't come into a treatment area, this is an opportunity to identify and try to get those folks services. So I guess my bottom line message is that I think there are some tweaks that we can do to the statute to try to encourage there to be more evaluations, better quality evaluations, and to give and to create the community services that give Greg and the courts the opportunity to move people into more stable, ongoing mental health services. I think that would be a very good thing, and we have a real good start with 3100. But we will need the funding to be able to do that. And but I think everyone who is working on this problem on the work group are really on the same page. And if you can imagine such a thing, we have district attorneys, we have law enforcement, we have sheriffs, we have community mental health in the hospital, and we're all, and patient advocates, and we are all on the same page.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Tromay?
Do you have defense attorneys on your group?
Yes, there is a defense attorney as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Or Senator Cruz.
Not that I want to complicate things, because it's not my nature. there's another angle to this. What we're seeing in healthcare transformation, and Douglas County is the first county. I'm surprised that they're one of the top four that are using your services. Douglas County is in the process right now of dumping mental health services into a private nonprofit. As part of the whole CCO thing, my conversation with Susan Morgan was, I said, why are you doing that? And she said, it's because there's no accountability in the system. Douglas County population of slightly under 100,000 in their mental health program, and it's basically just pass-through at this point. It's all state and federal money, no county money. They have 109 employees, okay? And nobody knows what they do. The point I'm making here is there may be, if we're doing a better job of directing the resources into the system, we may be able to get to the point where we have the ability to do the local evaluations if we're tasking people with the right things at the local level. So it's not just more money at the local level. It's also a matter of looking at the priorities, and so this brings the health authority into this play as well. So because I think there are going to be some other counties that are going to take this track with mental health services, and that's basically shifting them over to the CCOs. And in the case of Douglas County, they went to a nonprofit, and they're tied to Gobi, so I think it's going to be a good fit. But so we also, I think, need to be looking at what the health authority is focusing on when it comes to mental health and transformation as well. That's going to be a big piece of this.
Thank you. Anything further? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Dinip. We'll adjourn the House portion.
And this minute will adjourn itself as well. Thank you.
Thank you.